This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Down at the bottom of the world where no one goes,
cold heart of oceans, stop in wonder as he comes and stays.
Afraid to turn the TV news on? Worried about your country? Let me help you escape to a faraway world, Antarctica. Changes there are blowing scientists' minds. These are big, planetary-scale shifts in currents, sea level, glacier melt, and sea ice. The Australian island of Tasmania is a key gateway for polar science and exploration. We have two Tasmanian experts on board with the latest strange and shocking discoveries on the new emerging continent, way down at the bottom of the world. Welcome back to a new season of Radio EcoShock. Time is short, so let's dive right in with our first interview.
Radio EcoShock.
About 10 years ago, summer sea ice crashed around Antarctica. Vast areas of the sea were exposed to full solar power, changing ocean currents and the atmosphere. We need to explore what this abrupt change means. Edward Doddridge is research fellow in physical oceanography at the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies, that is in Tasmania. On July 1, 2025, Doddridge and 24 co-authors published a list of serious impacts from missing sea ice at the southern pole. From Tasmania, Edward Doddridge, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be here, Alex.
When I started broadcasting, the Arctic was losing summer sea ice, and it was very alarming, but Antarctica was gaining it almost. When did that change, and do we know why?
For a long time, this was so strange. It was something we called the Antarctic paradox, and you're absolutely right. For decades there, Antarctica was gaining sea ice very, very slowly, but still, there was a positive trend. That all changed in about 2014-2015. So the winter maximum in 2014 was the largest extent of sea ice around Antarctica that we've ever seen. And since then, it has dropped very, very rapidly. Now, we think that there were a few things that all came together to cause Antarctic sea ice to be expanding. One of those was the westerly winds were changing, largely because of the ozone hole. And that was making them a bit stronger, and those stronger winds were helping push cold water from Antarctica northwards, and that was making it a little bit easier to freeze and form the ice. We also know that the ice sheet on Antarctica was melting, and so we were getting some fresh cold water coming in at the surface, and that was also helping to isolate the surface ocean from the warmer ocean below it and expand the amount of sea ice. As I said, in 2015 or so, that all changed. 2016 and 17 were record lows, and since then, Antarctic sea ice has been almost constantly below that long-term average.
In a handy explainer in the conversation, you list four major impacts when Antarctic sea ice fails to form. I'd like to take them in order. First, you say ocean warming is compounding. Please explain.
So this is one of the big changes that we are really worried about for the extreme loss of summer sea ice in the Antarctic. Historically, the system reset every year. During winter, there was lots and lots of cooling, and any heat that had accumulated in the upper ocean just got vented out into the atmosphere. The ocean got cold, and the sea ice formed. We did a modeling study for this paper, and it showed that when you have an extreme loss of sea ice, like we did in the 2016-17 summer, or any of the past four summers, our model suggested it took over 3 years for that impact to dissipate. So you had heating because the ocean is darker and it absorbs more sunlight and it warms up during that summer. But rather than just disappearing over the wintertime, that heat sticks around. And if it sticks around to the next summer, and the next summer is a really low sea ice summer, you can build on that warming with more warming. And the last four summers that we've had have all been much, much lower than anything else we saw since the satellite record began in the late 1970s, which raises the really alarming possibility that warming from one summer is built on by the next summer, and this warmth compounds, and that's going to make it much, much harder to go back to a state where we're growing more sea ice.
And the second point was expect more icebergs. Why, and does that matter?
So this might not be something you really expect from sea ice changes, but one of the things that sea ice does is it dissipates the energy in ocean waves. The waves come in and they hit the sea ice, and as they break up the ice, they lose all of their energy and they get much, much smaller. So that means in a summer where there's almost no ice around the edge of Antarctica, that lots of that wave energy gets all the way to the coastal regions of Antarctica. And when it gets to the coast, it can hit the ice shelves, which are the floating extensions of the ice sheet on Antarctica. And those waves break and damage and fatigue those ice shelves to the point where they lose parts of themselves as icebergs. So parts of the ice shelf break off as icebergs and drift away. Now, losing an iceberg like that doesn't directly raise sea level, but what it does is it stops the ice shelves from being able to hold back all of the ice on the continent. So breaking away bits of the ice shelf lets the ice on the land flow into the ocean faster, and that's accelerating sea level rise. Now, we found that in a year with extreme low sea ice, you've got about twice as many icebergs as a normal year. So that's a really big difference. And it's also a process that isn't really included in our climate models, which means that future projections don't include this process that we've just identified, suggesting that sea level rise might happen even faster than our models are currently predicting.
Well, okay. And tell us about the wildlife who depend on that summer sea ice.
Almost all of the wildlife around Antarctica uses the sea ice in some form or another. Sometimes they'll use it as a refuge, as a place to hide from predators, or as a place to find food. So krill, for example, the tiny little crustaceans that essentially underpin the entire food web of the Southern Ocean, when they're larvae in their first winter, they come up and they live underneath the sea ice and they feed on the algae that grows on the base of it. So we think that that winter sea ice is super, super critical for those krill to get through their first year. And any change to that sea ice is going to have really big impacts on their ability to reproduce and to grow. But there are loads of other examples of this. Emperor penguins, perhaps the most iconic Antarctic species, they use sea ice as a breeding platform. So they form their colonies near the coast on a particular type of sea ice called fast ice. And that's called fast ice because it's fastened to the land. It's stuck there. And they go, they form their colonies, and the males incubate the eggs over the winter, if you've ever seen those incredible documentaries with the penguins all huddled in the cold. But it takes quite a while for the eggs to hatch and then for the chicks to grow and develop. And so as summer approaches, there's a race. The chicks need to grow up to the point where they have their adult feathers and they can go into the water safely before the ice breaks up. And historically, emperor penguins have done a beautiful job of being really in tune with that balance. But lately, the rhythm and the cycle of sea ice has been changing, and it's been breaking up earlier and earlier before those chicks are ready. And if that ice disappears before the chicks are ready and they have their adult plumage, they can't survive in the water. So the ice breaks up and every chick in that colony dies. This is a pretty confronting thing to find. There are other animals like crab-eater seals that give birth on the ice, and they need large, stable ice platforms for a few weeks while they're weaning their pups. If they don't have that, they're at greater risk of being preyed upon by predators like orcas. And lots of species of seal and penguin go onto the ice to replace their feathers or their fur. And while they're doing that, they need to stay out of the water because just like the emperor penguin chicks, they're not particularly waterproof, which means if they get wet, they get hypothermic, they lose lots of energy and potentially die. So the wildlife around Antarctica has evolved to a point where it is really in tune with the rhythms of the sea ice, and changes to that have enormous impacts on all of those creatures.
I was surprised to find that lack of sea ice can make access to Antarctica more difficult for the base supply ships. I thought it might be easier to get to shore without it.
It's a bit counterintuitive, isn't it? So in one sense, you're right. Without sea ice, you could take a normal boat right up to the shore. But National Antarctic programs actually use the sea ice as a platform to unload onto. So they don't need to build a wharf if you can have sea ice that you drive your trucks out onto and you load up from the ship directly. Now, if that sea ice is no longer thick enough or stable enough or it breaks up too early in the season, you can't use it like that, which means either you need to unload onto small boats and ferry everything back and forth across the open water like that, which is very difficult and very weather dependent, or you need a wharf. Now, some Antarctic stations do have wharves. A lot of them don't. And the ones that don't currently use sea ice to unload. So we expect that as summertime sea ice becomes less reliable, less stable, and disappears in many cases, these programs won't be able to use it as a platform for unloading supplies and fuel to the stations.
As good science does, your team's review of ice loss impacts raise even more questions. Is the area of ice loss large enough to significantly alter the reflectivity of Earth? Does it change Earth energy imbalance?
Absolutely. It really does. So you might have heard of something called polar amplification. And this is the process whereby the poles warm up faster than the rest of the world. And that's essentially because as they lose sea ice during the summertime, they absorb more of the incoming sunlight and energy from the sun. Now, when we talk about global warming, we often talk about it in terms of radiative forces, which is how much extra energy is the Earth absorbing over every square meter because of greenhouse gases. At the moment, that's about 3 watts per meter squared more energy because of greenhouse gases. And sea ice loss is adding an extra 10 to 15% to that energy imbalance. So you can think of it as the loss of sea ice in the poles is making climate change about 10 to 15% worse than it would be if the sea ice weren't changing. And that's a pretty huge number just from the loss of one part of the climate system.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with our guest, Edward Doddridge. He's a research fellow in physical oceanography at the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies in Tasmania. He led a study examining all the ways the surprising loss of Antarctic sea ice changes the world. What is the impact on the flow of the ocean currents around Antarctica when there is no sea ice above? Does it make a difference?
This is right on the edge of our understanding at the moment. So there are lots of different ocean currents around, and we know that the surface currents interact with the sea ice really directly. When the sea ice is there, the currents flow underneath and they rub on the ice, and they're actually losing energy through that process. So the sea ice slows down ocean currents, it slows down the weather systems of the ocean, we call them eddies. And so losing sea ice could potentially mean that those currents are a little bit stronger, those eddies live for a little bit longer. But there are also deeper ocean currents that are impacted by sea ice in different ways. So when sea ice forms, it leaves behind this cold, salty brine that sinks down into the deep ocean, eventually flowing down the continental shelves and filling up the deep abyss. As we form less sea ice, we expect to be forming less of that cold, salty brine, and so we might be slowing down those deep ocean currents. Now, this is also related to the melt of the ice on the land on both Antarctica and Greenland, because as you put that fresh water into the ocean, it also slows down those deep ocean currents. So teasing apart exactly how much of it is due to sea ice changes and how much due to the ice sheet melt is a bit of a tricky problem. But we expect to have really huge changes in that deep overturning circulation in the coming decades. And in fact, we have some measurements suggesting it might already have slowed down by 30%.
What does it mean that sea ice is now disappearing seasonally at both poles at once? I mean, if the alternating polar sea ice was based on astronomical factors like changes in Earth's tilt towards the sun, why are those factors not working now?
So we are still seeing a really strong seasonal impact on sea ice. There is more in the wintertime in both the Arctic and the Antarctic than there is during the summer. So that impact of the Earth's tilt is, and the seasons is still really the maybe the dominant control on sea ice. And what we're seeing really is a drop in sea ice across all seasons at both poles now. And so I don't think it's really that we're losing the impact of the orbital factors, things like the Earth's tilt or the sun's angle, that sort of stuff. Really what we're seeing is the impact of the Earth becoming warmer. And now, for quite a long time, our climate models have told us that a warmer Earth should have less ice. And really, that just makes sense from a really basic, intuitive perspective. But it's always nice when our big computer models and our tools and the algorithms we use give us answers that make sense. And as I said before, for a while, the question was, why isn't Antarctica losing ice? That was the paradox, the thing that we didn't really understand. And we are now at a point where both poles are losing ice all the time. And so the question now is understanding how rapidly is that going to continue into the future.
Did you, by any chance, look at the effect of disappearing Antarctic sea ice on plankton, the base of the food chain?
We did. We tried looking at this. Now, there are a few caveats, and as a scientist, obviously, I love my caveats. Looking at the phytoplankton, the tiny little plants at the base of the food chain, is really hard. If you use satellites, you can't see through clouds and you can't see through the sea ice, which means that you can only measure how much chlorophyll, the little green pigment in phytoplankton, there is when the skies are clear and the ocean doesn't have any ice on top. Now, around Antarctica, those two things happen a lot. There's a lot of cloud, there's a lot of ice, which means that our measurements aren't as regular and consistent as we would like. But we do have some measurements. We also have measurements from these autonomous drifting robotic floats that go around the ocean. They sit at about a kilometre deep, and every 10 days they sink down to 2 kilometres and then they come back up to the surface. And some of them are covered in these really amazing sensors that measure all sorts of biological and chemical properties. And so those can tell us how much phytoplankton there is in the top 2 kilometres. And if we combine all of these measurements, we can try and understand how the plankton is changing with the sea ice. Now, our expectation was that when you had extra sea ice melt, you would form a little layer of colder, fresher water at the surface of the ocean, and that layer would have more iron than the rest of the ocean around it. And the iron is really critical, because around Antarctica, iron is the limiting ingredient in phytoplankton growth. There's lots of nitrate and phosphate and the other nutrients they need, but iron is the one they are always looking for. So we expected that sea ice melt would lead to an earlier growth of phytoplankton and probably more growth of phytoplankton. Now, what we found was a bit confusing. In some places we saw that signal, in some places we didn't, and we haven't been able to dig down to exactly what is controlling the differences there. So that is still an open question, but we expect sea ice to be impacting the growth of these phytoplankton. We just haven't worked out exactly what's going on yet.
Another new paper came out in Nature on June 18th, led by Elise Drost, and that study finds, quote, sea ice duration controls ocean stratification. So more open ocean adds to mixing, which brings up carbon-rich waters, increasing release of carbon dioxide, the main warming gas. What are your thoughts on the relationships between sea ice and the carbon cycle?
This is one of the potential impacts of sea ice loss that really, really worries me. At the moment, we know that the Southern Ocean is what we call a sink of CO2. It absorbs more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere than it releases back. So overall, the Southern Ocean is taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and moving it down into the ocean. Now, that's really important for us because when it takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, it stops that carbon dioxide from warming up the planet. So the Southern Ocean is really helping us a lot at the moment by keeping global warming lower than it would otherwise be. Now, a lot of the processes that are involved in taking that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and moving it into the ocean are intimately tied to sea ice. So there's the physical process whereby CO2 just dissolves into the ocean, and that's really sensitive to the temperature. So the warmer the ocean water is, the less CO2 it can absorb. As we lose ice, we know the ocean warms up, so that suggests that maybe losing the sea ice will inhibit the amount of CO2 that can dissolve into the ocean. The other process that's really important is biology. So the phytoplankton, just like plants on land, consume carbon dioxide and sunlight and release oxygen. And then they grow, something eats them, or they die and they sink down into the deep ocean. And again, that is a route for getting carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and the surface ocean down into the deep ocean, where it no longer contributes to global warming. As the sea ice changes, we expect the ocean currents to change and the biology to change, as well as the physics of the upper ocean. So that paper you mentioned was a regional case study looking at a time series just near one of the Antarctic stations on the Antarctic Peninsula. And they found that in years when there was less sea ice, the atmosphere and the wind mixed the upper ocean and mixed carbon from the deep ocean up to the surface so that it could go back out into the atmosphere. Now, it's a little difficult to extrapolate from a regional case study like that to all the way around Antarctica, but the processes involved make sense. You lose ice, you get more wind mixing at the surface of the ocean, and you have the potential to bring carbon back up from the ocean into the atmosphere. So if we are indeed on the precipice of a new regime where the sea ice has changed, and that change in sea ice reduces the Southern Ocean's ability to absorb carbon dioxide, that is not good news for us at all, because it suggests that the loss of sea ice not only warms the planet faster by absorbing more sunlight and energy, but it also is going to accelerate global warming by reducing the amount of carbon dioxide that goes into the ocean, or potentially even taking carbon dioxide out of the ocean and putting it back into the atmosphere. Either of those processes would make the world warm up even faster.
An earlier study in Nature, December 18, 2024, found record low Antarctic sea ice in 2023, increased ocean heat loss, and storms. Wow. I mean, Antarctica is already one of the stormiest places in the world. That's where the scary Mariner stories come from. Did you cover storms in your paper, or how do you see this developing?
Yeah, I saw that paper too. Absolutely, this is already an incredibly stormy place. You know, the roaring 40s, the furious 50s, strong winds and big storms. So we didn't look at storminess directly in our paper, but one of the things that we should be aware of when we're talking about storms in the Southern Ocean is that the stronger the wind is, the bigger the waves are. And so those big waves will come and hit the sea ice and break it up. And you can actually see when a big storm passes through, because it breaks up the sea ice and it reduces the amount of sea ice coverage. So this is another possible feedback that should really worry us, because when you lose wintertime sea ice, that study shows that you get more storms and storminess around Antarctica. And those storms are going to generate bigger waves, which is going to help break up the ice and reduce the ice coverage even more, fueling more heat from the ocean going into the atmosphere and driving more storms. That sort of positive feedback loop suggests that we may end up with more storms and less ice as an ongoing feature around Antarctica.
Well, led by Simon Josie from the Oceanography Center in Southampton, this team also found lower summer sea ice led to, quote, an unprecedented doubling of midwinter ocean heat loss. How does that work, Edward?
So during the wintertime, the atmosphere is really cold around Antarctica. And the thing about the ocean is that it has what's called, it has a really large heat capacity. So heat capacity is how we measure the amount of energy that it takes to change the temperature of something. So air has a a lower heat capacity. It can't hold as much energy for every given temperature change. But water has an enormous heat capacity. It's also really dense compared to air. And so the seasonal variation in the ocean temperature is much less than the atmosphere temperature. So during winter, the atmosphere is much colder than the ocean, and so heat is moving from the ocean into the atmosphere. So that study by Sam and Josie and the others at the National Oceanography Centre in Southampton found that you had much more heat going into the atmosphere from the ocean. And as we've talked about already, the loss of summer sea ice leads to the surface ocean absorbing more heat from the incoming sunlight. And so it's storing a bit more heat. As you get to the winter, that heat comes out into the atmosphere.
Your research depends partly on steady data from the U.S. Department of Defense satellites. What is the latest on that?
This has been a bit of a moving feast. So a couple of months ago, the U.S. Department of Defense announced that they were no longer going to be providing the data from a particular set of satellites. So these are the Defense Meteorological Satellite Program satellites. They are, as satellites go, quite old satellites, and they are past their official end-of-life period. But when a satellite is up in the space and is still working, we usually like to collect the data from it because that data is very valuable. So they announced that they were going to cut that off even though the satellites were still working. The community were alarmed and concerned about this because one of the things that we like to do as scientists is we like to have a really long, consistent time series of data where we can look at the measurements from this year and we can compare them to measurements 20 years ago or 40 years ago and trust that those comparisons can give us really good measurements of how things are changing. Now, we have other satellites that we can use to measure sea ice. And in many ways, you could argue they're actually better satellites. The sensors are more advanced. They give us higher resolution measurements. So the grid size for the pixels in the photos is smaller. So you get more information from them. But the problem is comparing those more modern satellites with the older measurements is really tricky. And we haven't yet, as a community, come up with a way to do really accurate comparisons between them. And so losing that long time series is going to affect our ability to monitor how things are changing over time. Now, the U.S. Department of Defense have said that they will continue to provide the data until September 2026, which is the official cutoff date for the satellites. That is the absolute end of life. At that point, they will no longer be running those satellites. So in one sense, it's fabulous that they are going to continue providing the data right up until the very end. It was concerning simply to be told that this data stream was going to finish, and we're very grateful that they have relented on that and engaged with the community to some extent. It's nice that it gives us the best part of a year to work out, to continue calibrating and cross-comparing these two different products so we can have the best possible time series. Changing sensors is always going to be a bit of a problem for us. That's the reality of trying to work with really long time series.
And finally, I hope to find out more about Antarctic sea ice loss and teleconnections. I found a half dozen papers suggesting teleconnections from tropical conditions influence sea ice around the Southern Ocean. What about the other way around? Surely such a large seasonal change in the Southern Ocean must influence weather beyond the pole, maybe in South America, Australia, or even right up to North America. What do we know?
At the moment, we don't know a lot about this. There hasn't been a huge amount of work on trying to understand how the sea ice changes are going to affect weather and climate further north. Now, you mentioned connections from the tropics down to Antarctica. Absolutely, that's very well established, and we have some of the mechanisms involved in that, particular atmospheric processes that help transfer those signals from the tropics to the poles. There has been a little bit of work trying to understand how the sea ice changes may affect things further north. One study suggested that massive losses of Antarctic sea ice could change the rainfall in Australian farming regions by 20 to 30%, which is a pretty significant change if you're trying to farm crops or animals in those areas. But this is really at the forefront of the scientific research at the moment. And unfortunately, we just don't have those answers.
From the Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies in Tasmania, we've been speaking with Dr. Edward Doddridge. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Edward, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Sea ice loss around Antarctica is just one of the mega-scale changes down there as we heat up the planet. For the overview and the latest, we go to a well-known expert in the field. We hear a lot about change in the Arctic, but not Antarctica. Yet the South Pole holds many world-scale risks and its own unique tipping points. In just one example, sea level rise from melting Antarctic glaciers could flood major coastal cities and delta croplands around the world. Dr. Matt King is director at the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. He is a professor at the University of Tasmania. We last spoke in December 2024. That was before the voyage of a research ship to the South Pole and before dozens of papers this year on Antarctica, many by Australian researchers. From Hobart, Tasmania, Matt King, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
We thought the South Pole was a slow-changing giant. Tell us about new science warning about abrupt changes already happening there.
Yeah, well, Alex, it's not just you who thought Antarctica was a slow-changing giant. I mean, it was very widely held until the 1990s or the 2000s that was pretty much the case, that Antarctica slowly changed, maybe over centuries or millennia, and that we've been proved to be wrong. Antarctica has demonstrated very clearly to us, as the more we've been able to observe it from space and in the field, we've seen that the Antarctic ice sheet and the Southern Ocean can change very rapidly in ways that we're only really just starting to get a handle on. And so abrupt change has begun to emerge. You know, the first thing that comes to mind when I think of abrupt change is the collapse of the Larsen B ice shelf in 2002. So this is a floating extension of the glaciers flowing through the Antarctic Peninsula. They come out and hit the ocean and they start floating and they form this ice shelf. It splintered into thousands of icebergs in the course of just 6 weeks. That was captured from space. We could see this unfolding. It was a very dramatic event. It was certainly abrupt and it was persistent and sustained. And as a result of that, the glaciers that were feeding into it sped up by a factor of 2 to 6. And then over the next decade or so, some of those glaciers lowered by 300 metres, 400 metres. And so there's very dramatic change. But more recently, we've seen abrupt change in the Antarctic sea ice. That's the frozen ocean around Antarctica. It was very steady for all the way back to the beginning of the first satellite observations in the late 1970s. Very steady, maybe even slightly increasing in the years up to 2017. And then it fell off a cliff. We lost huge areas of sea ice and they haven't been fully recovered. And this year, again, is sort of near record low levels. And so it seems like we've entered, very abruptly entered a new phase, a new regime. And we've also seen other things on land, like the greening of the Antarctic Peninsula as glaciers and ice retreats in those areas. We're seeing vegetation quite rapidly, habitat areas that were formerly glaciated, and we're seeing very rapid changes in those areas of ocean species, penguins, moving southward as the warmer waters come in from the north.
So much happening, and most of us know about the dangerous weakening of the Gulf Stream that warms the East Coast, the UK, Scandinavia. The movie The Day After Tomorrow popularized all that if it were to shut down suddenly. But a major current in the Southern Ocean conveyor belt has already almost stopped around Antarctica. Could you talk to us about what's going on there?
Yeah, well, I mean, that Day After Tomorrow movie actually starts with the last of the ice shelf, and so it actually starts off with that very thing I was just discussing. But there are big changes going on in the Southern Ocean that have global ramifications. The oceans are made up of a series of conveyor belts that transport heat and nutrients and oxygen from the high latitudes or the deep ocean to the equatorial regions, and then up into the northern hemisphere, and then sinks down deep and comes back again. It really is a global conveyor belt. And of course, that movement of heat affects the planet's climate. The movement of nutrients and oxygen sustains global ocean marine life. And what's been observed just in the last 2 years or 3 years is a 20% reduction in the Antarctic component of that global overturning circulation. At least part of that has been driven by the melting of land ice, or the increased melting of land ice from Antarctica, and that's been interfering with the ability of dense waters to sink to the bottom and sort of sustain the Antarctic part of that conveyor belt. Sea ice has also played a role in another part of Antarctica, where changes to formation of sea ice has also affected the rate of sinking of surface waters down to the depths, and again that's part of that global conveyor belt. So we've seen a slowdown. What's perhaps even more concerning is that the best model projections we have suggest that we would expect more, maybe a 40% slowdown in the coming decades. But two, those models suggest that the slowdown we're seeing now shouldn't have occurred yet. So it's happening faster than the models project. And so we've got work to do on making the models more realistic. But there are alarm bells ringing in the south, and these things don't stay in Antarctica. They have global ramifications.
Yes, the future of the Southern Ocean ice still seems a bit uncertain. One headline this summer said, Southern Ocean salinity may be triggering sea ice loss. I wonder, does that solve the mystery of why Antarctic sea ice was growing until about 2012, 2014, and then pulled back precipitously?
So I think what we're seeing in terms of trying to understand what's going on with Antarctic sea ice is still very much in the healthy scientific debate. It seems clear that the ocean has played a major role, and something has changed in the ocean that's causing the change in patterns of sea ice and the spatial variation of those changes, because it's not happening the same everywhere. And so I think at the moment we're seeing in the literature various ideas being put forward about what the mechanisms are, how it relates to broader scale climate change or climate variability. And so I think we're still very much in the process of trying to understand it, having been caught very much by surprise when this really started kicking off in 2017 and then much more dramatically in 2023. Probably the truth is there's a bunch of different things going on, but we'll need to wait until we see how the science plays out to really understand the drivers of this, and hence have a good understanding or a better understanding of how that might change in the future. Because the next step, what happens next is the key. Because this is not just a sort of like a scientific curiosity. We've talked about the role of sea ice in global ocean circulation and climate and ocean life. But as you melt that sea ice back, you're replacing all that beautiful white snow-covered sea ice with dark ocean, so it absorbs more heat. And there's another feedback that actually, as the ice melts away, the ocean warms more, melts more ice. And so these things have great scientific interest, but they're also hugely societal importance. That's an energy balance.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Matt King, a leader in Australian and Antarctic climate science. Matt, tell us about this year's ship-based expedition of scientists to Antarctica. Were there surprises? Do you expect more science to come out of that as results are studied?
Yeah, look, this was a very exciting voyage for Australian researchers, especially, Alex, because it was our the maiden science voyage for our new icebreaker called Noina, funded by the Australian federal government. It had replaced our previous icebreaker that had worked tirelessly for 30 years or so. And then there's been a gap while this new icebreaker was sort of commissioned and tested and finally headed off to the Antarctic to the Denman Glacier, which is a remarkable glacier that no one, you know, most people have never heard of. But on its own, it holds enough ice to raise global sea levels by 1.5 metres. So just one glacier. So you think about standing on the edge of the ocean, a slightly short woman might be 1.5 metres tall. Just think about what would take to fill up the global oceans by that height of a person. That's this one glacier system. Now, that's not going to melt, you know, anytime soon, but it is changing. There's signs of retreat of this glacier, acceleration of this glacier, but people have hardly studied it. You know, the area in front of it on the continental shelf was literally unmapped. The amount of work going on the glacier has been very limited indeed. And so last year we had a team of people from Australia's university sector, particularly working on the glacier itself, on land and onto the ice. And then this year we had the complementary voyage where we could finally get the icebreaker in, start to map some of those areas, start to map the ocean and its properties, map the seafloor, understand what biological life is going on, which has an important role in absorption of carbon dioxide. And so the team went in there. There were 60 researchers on board, and it was really quite remarkable. They had to go slightly later than we wanted to, so they arrived there in March, and that's when the period in Antarctica when the sea ice, the frozen ocean, is starting to form again. It melts back in the summer, a long way back into the coastline, almost always all the way to the coastline in many locations, and then it starts to form again. And sea ice makes it hard just to get around. Even though you've got an icebreaker, it slows things down and makes some areas very difficult to get to. There was concern that the area we were trying to get to would be jammed up with sea ice. And as it turned out, there was almost no sea ice to be seen this current season. We don't know if that's part of the broader picture of sea ice or if that was just this area just happened to be, you know, luckily low. But the ship got in, mapped huge areas of the continental shelf, collected seafloor samples, a whole bunch of cores from the seafloor mud, which tells us about the past climate over the last thousands to tens of thousands or longer years. We're looking for significant changes in seafloor topography that might have indicated the glaciers were much bigger in the past. We didn't see a lot of variation on the seafloor there, so that was a bit of a surprise. We saw marine life where we wouldn't have expected marine life to be. So, you know, there were a bunch of surprises, but the work is still being worked up, and it will probably take 5 years at least for the bulk of it to come out, and then there will still be legacy for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, especially when you're talking about, well, we actually now know what the shape of the seafloor looks like. That'll go into computer models that will be thinking about how do you get warm ocean water to the ice sheet. And so the benefits of this voyage will be out forever.
That's fantastic stuff. Fantastic for scientists and great for all of us who are trying to understand this world. How much does change in Antarctica affect weather in Australia? Does it?
Yeah, so one of the first reasons why Australia got into the Antarctic, you know, fieldwork business back in the early 1900s was for weather observations. And some of the most valuable weather observations for Australian forecasting come from the Southern Ocean and the Antarctic. And so there are occasions where you can see from a satellite image a low-pressure system sitting over the Southern Ocean between Antarctica and Australia, and you see this swirling cloud spiral sitting there, and the southern tip of the low-pressure system will be touching the Antarctic coastline, and the northern tip will be projecting into Australia. And so what goes on in the Antarctic and the Southern Ocean has a very strong impact on Australia's broader climate and also impacts on our rainfall and drought, although we don't have as much information as we need yet about what change in the Antarctic will do to Australia's weather and climate. And so that's something that we're trying to work on more. flipping it the other way, there's some very interesting work that's been done here in Australia over a number of years where they've recognised a correlation between the snowfall rate or the deposition of salts in an ice core in coastal Antarctica with that correlates with rainfall rates on the east coast of Australia, where most of Australia's population lives. And the thing is that the ice core goes back 1,000 or 2,000 years. And so they've been able to look and see that there are indications of multiple decade-long droughts on the eastern coast of Australia that were never known from observational records. And so it's informing on, you know, water resource management, the idea that there could be a 3 or 4 decade severe drought in East Antarctica, even without an altered climate, just for the natural variability. It's sort of sobering, and that information is coming out of Antarctica because the two are linked.
As everyone knows, climate science funded by the U.S. federal government has been slashed. The U.S. intends to dock its only U.S. Antarctic research icebreaker. Other countries may have to pick up that slack. China has been funding and producing a lot of new science on climate and Earth systems. The Chinese built 2 bases in Antarctica. How do you see China's activity at the South Pole, Matt?
China's definitely interested in science, and we've seen that with a very dramatic rise in publication from Chinese researchers. Their output's tripled from 2017 to 2024, while the Western nations, the U.S., Britain and Australia declined by, you know, the US declined by 20% over a decade. There was a COVID blip where more people published things, but there's sort of long-term negative trends amongst some of the key players in the West, and China's been ramping up that activity. A lot of that growth has come from probably computer lab-based or remote sensing activities that don't depend on field work, but they are obviously ramping up their ability to do field work in the Antarctic as well. And so China, like every other nation, is interested in science, but they're also interested, like every other nation, in geopolitics. And so both of those things are going on here, I've got no doubt. We're keen to continue to work with our Chinese research colleagues who are doing great research and in order to accelerate the work we're doing. But we also need all the other nations to actually be coming to the table and not decelerating but accelerating, especially in the face of all these surprises and abrupt changes that are emerging. So we desperately need the US to change course. We need the UK and Australia to invest more and in order to get ahead of these surprises that are coming at us.
And as you've written about, New Zealand is pulling back a little from their Antarctic research program.
Well, I mean, I think all the nations are struggling at the moment with station rebuilds. So a lot of the infrastructure at the Antarctic stations, and so New Zealand, Australia is the same. The US, you know, they built a lot of these infrastructures in the 1970s and 80s, and they're sort of reaching end of life, and they're out of date in terms of modern safety standards and compliance and energy efficiency, and so they're expensive to run. And so you can understand why nations are sort of focusing perhaps the budget on those. That does come at the detriment, and those sorts of rebuilding activities can take, you know, 5 years. And so you set back 5 years in a time of dramatic change where we need to get information. So, we do think that you know, infrastructure is important, but the infrastructure is there for the science, and so we need to keep on pushing the science out there and actually continuing to accelerate that. And so, yeah, we do need nations to step up in this regard and see just how dramatic the changes are and just how important those changes are to everyone.
Do you think it's possible the vast Southern Ocean could delay the worst effects of climate change in the Southern Hemisphere due to the lag time between ocean heating versus land heating?
Well, we certainly are seeing that the Southern Ocean already is delaying the impacts of climate change because the Southern Ocean absorbs huge amounts of carbon dioxide, huge amounts of heat. And if the Southern Ocean wasn't doing that, that heat would be in the atmosphere and that carbon dioxide would be in the atmosphere. And I think it's something of the order of 12% of all human emissions have been absorbed by the Southern Ocean. So, you know, that's an enormous amount of carbon dioxide. Of course, that does, you know, the heat that's being absorbed by the Southern Ocean does mean that the heat's not in the atmosphere impacting on the broader climate. But ultimately, that heat then will come to bear on marine life and the future of the ice sheet. So that heat's being stored up, but it's going to have an impact in the climate system, and we're starting to see that now. So, yes, the Southern Ocean is something we should value. I was involved in a piece of work that actually just put a number on that absorption of carbon dioxide. And if you price that at European values, it's $180 billion a year worth of carbon that's being absorbed by the Southern Ocean. And if the Southern Ocean wasn't doing it, that job, would have to find that $180 billion a year from other parts of the global economy.
So you're the director of the Australian Centre for Excellence in Antarctic Science. What will be the focus for your unit now?
Yeah, so we're one of those organisations that's actually facing a funding cliff. Our funding is due to taper to zero at the middle of next year. We're talking to government about, you know, sustained funding for Antarctic university-based research, which drives about 80% of Australia's activities, either leading it or supporting it in one way or another. So there's a huge piece of work that's sort of funded on short-term, you know, not fully coordinated activity, and so we think there needs to be consolidated, coordinated, and sustained funding for the university sector so we can drive more of the research forward. So we're looking at sort of tapering down, and we'll be looking to wrap up all of our research as best we can, but at the same time trying to convince government to go, well, we can't stop this, we need to keep going. And so we're having those conversations with our elected officials, and, you know, they're very receptive to that, especially here in Tasmania where, you know, Antarctic research really matters. And so, you know, we're hoping to get the ear of the relevant minister in government and the federal government that they might actually continue to support the work that we're doing, but in a better way going forward with greater coordination.
As we wrap up here, is there any other new study or research that you would like to talk about?
I think we talked about abrupt change, but I think the paper that came out in Nature last week, which was led by largely by an Australian group of researchers, including those in my centre, that was a tremendous piece of work because we saw the degree of not just the changes but the interconnectedness of the system, and that isn't always fully appreciated. That actually the change in one part of the system can have cascading effects into other parts of the system. But the other thing I got from that paper as well is just that actually the tipping points, the abrupt sustained changes in the Antarctic, may be in some cases more severe than previously thought and maybe more severe than the Arctic. So the sea ice in the Arctic has often been thought as a tipping point. There's some questions around that because there might be a recoverability there once climate has stabilised. But it seems like the Antarctic sea ice may not have a recoverability, at least not for centuries. And so that was pretty surprising to me. And again, another piece of sobering information that the changes that are going on now might have not sort of decades of impact, but centuries of impact. And so, you know, we've got to pay attention to that and act in a similarly abrupt way to respond in terms of mitigating climate warming.
Abrupt climate action needed. From Hobart, Tasmania, we've been speaking with Professor Matt King. You can find links to all the new science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Matt King, thank you for helping our listeners on Radio EcoShock.
It was great to be with you, Alex.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
I hope this little tour of climate change in Antarctica helps us all understand more about the big forces at work in the natural and physical realms. The sea level will rise for at least 1,000 years, no matter what your politics or economy may be. I'm Alex Smith. Get all our past programs absolutely free from the show website at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and please stay on board for another wild ride this fall. This show song features lyrics by Alex Smith, but the music is AI generated.
Down at the bottom of the world, where no one goes, hidden giants, hidden chains that no one knows.
days.